Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Okay, our panel this morning, Liz Carlin is a publisher of TheBriefing.ie and a political scientist. Oisín Coughlan is a public policy analyst. Mary Regan is political editor with the Irish Independent and Sunday Independent. And Professor Alan Barrett is a research professor at the ESRI. Good morning, everyone.
Morning. Morning.
Mary Regan, you got up at 5 o'clock this morning to come up to us, I believe you were. So the action yesterday was in New Ross and Derrynane. You were at New Ross at the Kennedy Summer School. So Billy Kelleher was down there, Gareth Sheridan was there as well. Tell us a bit about the vibes down there.
For some people it was all about Electric Picnic, but for some of us it was about the summer schools and the Kennedy Summer School.
Electric Picnic for
New Ross. So yeah, I left New Ross at 5:30 this morning to be here. And Billy Kelleher, as you said, was there yesterday. Gareth Sheridan was there. And, you know, it seems, I think, a couple of themes now are emerging in this presidential contest, which really heated up over the past few days. One of them is that it seems to be open enough, I think, in Fianna Fáil at this stage. It's going to be hard for a lot of TDs to defy the party leader. And Micheál Martin is ringing people not once, not twice, some of them three times. Jim Gavin himself is on the phone today as we speak. He is speaking to TDs, but there hasn't been a sort of Fine Gael style steamrolling over Billy Kelleher, like as Fine Gael did to Sean Kelly, for example.
So
there
we hasn't could been have seen like a load of people coming out over the course of the weekend, it hasn't been like
that could be strategic in some way, because by keeping the conversation open for a bit longer, the focus stays on Fianna Fáil and their candidates. But I think there are people, I've spoken to pretty much all of them, I think, over the past couple of days in the parliamentary party who are weighing things up, really. The senior ministers, by and large, will be backing their party leadership's man. That's Jim Gavin. There will be a number of TDs, you know, who aren't saying and are genuinely, I think, weighing this up. We haven't heard from Jim Gavin yet. Okay, people know who he is. They know what he's about. We haven't heard from Jim Gavin, the politician.
Yeah, is it strange that we haven't at this point?
Well, I would have expected him to have spoken. I thought it was a little bit odd that Jack
Chambers...
And we're
here for him, by the way.
Yeah, we were all there.
He has a rush of blood in the next hour or two, yeah.
And, I think there was a plan here, which was that he was to be presented to the parliamentary party next week or the week after. And he and Micheál Martin had their sort of military style operation ready to go. Billy Kelleher upset that in some ways, not intentionally, because he didn't know what the plan was, by starting on Thursday to ring around to talk to people in the parliamentary party, have those conversations. And the Jim Gavin, Micheál Martin plan was a little bit, you know, they had to refocus. They had to, you know, I wrote, Jim Gavin as an army man will know that no best plan ever survives, you know, combat with the enemy.
Contact with the enemy.
And it's not that there was an enemy in Billy Kelleher. It's just that their plan met something unforeseen.
Now,
so they were forced then to start their ring around, or Micheál Martin was. Jack Chambers started it then, Micheál Martin, on Thursday night.
So you think that was a bit of a panic and a flurry?
Yeah,
there
it was a rear guard action is the way I see it.
You make an interesting point in your piece today in the Sunday Indo that Jim O'Callaghan is one to watch.
Jim O'Callaghan isn't saying what way he's going to vote. I don't think he's going to say. Now, every other minister, more or less, I'd say by the end of today, will have come out in favour of Jim Gavin. Jim O'Callaghan is interesting to watch. I mean, he could just be respecting the process. The parliamentary party get to, you know, have a process here and pick the democratic process of the party.
Because that's the kind he is.
But he could also, and this is something some TDs have suspected maybe, you know, he's looking at what the grassroots, what the party membership is interested in here, and maybe, you know, playing a bit of a listening game, you know, but also there's a point of difference there that he has with Jack Chambers, who Jack Chambers is now has been the person who's led the way on Micheál Martin's behalf with the Jim Gavin nomination. And, you know, if you're looking at the future leadership of Fianna Fáil, you know, Micheál Martin is Taoiseach for another 2 years, but what's going to happen beyond that, you would have to be looking at Jim O'Callaghan versus Jack Chambers.
Okay, okay.
And, you know, you could kind of saying, are the battle lines now being drawn for how things go in the party and how this all plays out and where that lands down the line?
Oisín, could this be the kind of quiet, safe revolution against Micheál Martin that a lot of the backbenchers have been afraid to do for a long time?
I think so. I think it says a number of things. I think firstly it says that Micheál Martin's lost track of when summer ends, because he obviously felt, well, if I'm ready to go in the first week of September...
He got in by the end of summer.
Yes, but as any parent knows, summer now ends a week ago. Kids went back to school on the 22nd, 21st of August.
This week things began
to get going again, and obviously
Billy Keller was going on school summertime.
And on the shifting school calendar, and really, you know, there was definitely agitation in the FF grassroots, given that the attention has been on Sinn Féin and on Catherine Connolly and on Fine Gael. So I think he just left it too late for his master plan, because it's very clear, just reading the papers, that the intention was a coronation. And Billy Keller's line, I think it is, that a Republican party, we expect votes, is a strong one. And there's now, I think there is also, as Mary says, they don't want to be seen to do what happened to Sean Kelly. That looked a bit unnecessary. But I think while the discussion in Fine Gael could have been good for them between the two candidates, in Fianna Fáil, the division's a bit starker. It's between a leadership pick who isn't of the party, really, versus a favoured figure in the party. That's a different dynamic. And I do think it could spell trouble for Micheál Martin, because it's a secret ballot if they get on the paper. And as you say, on the one hand, this is the man who people said might never be Taoiseach, the first Fianna Fáil leader, never be Taoiseach. Now he's Taoiseach for the second time, the height of his powers, and yet the end of the horizon is in sight already, 2 years down the line. So people are on manoeuvres already.
Okay, and when power starts seeping away, Alan Barrett, you were looking at Mary Regan's piece. What's your take on the kind of flurry of events of the last few days?
Well, I mean, to start with a slightly trivial point, I mean, obviously this is the highest office in the land, but from a sort of political spectator sport perspective, this has really become way more interesting than we thought it was going to be a number of weeks ago. And I think going back a number of weeks, speaking more as a citizen than an informed commentator, I think there was a bit of a sense of sort of frustration that the highest office on the land, there weren't more people sort of entering the race. It didn't seem to have been taken with the sort of seriousness or whatever like that. And again, if you look at the very, very distinguished people who have had this role over a period of time, just the sort of slow bicycle race and the slow sense which the sort of significant people were coming forward, all of a sudden the campaign has really sprung to life. But just to take a couple of angles on it, and again back to the Fianna Fáil focus, I had forgotten this, but given that Fianna Fáil haven't contested an election since 1997. It is quite remarkable, really, that if they're sort of looking to earlier playbooks, that it is an entirely different circumstance. That I think in 1997, I mean, this is when Bertie Ahern won his first election, Fianna Fáil were probably getting 35 or 40% of the vote, which is obviously such a different circumstance. So whichever Fianna Fáil person gets the nomination, it's a very, very different landscape.
A lot of people are making about Jim Gavin, that you need someone with a greater reach than...
Absolutely, but no matter what way, this could be breaking down, I mean, we could have Catherine Connolly plus a Sinn Féin candidate, so you'll have two candidates on the left. You could have a Fianna Fáil and a Fine Gael, and let's call it the sort of centre-right. And so it sort of strikes me that whoever is going to win this election is going to require transfers. And I think this could be a problem on the left, because we know historically there's antagonism, for example, between Labour and the Soc Dems. There's antagonisms between, you know, those parties of the left and Sinn Féin. So it's not entirely clear how well transfers will work. And then on the Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil side, again, if you read the papers, there's more rumblings about this as sort of, you know, the old antagonisms, in a sense, are coming to the fore. It's almost like in both parties, they see vulnerabilities, you know, and it's not, we've talked about Micheál Martin's vulnerability here, but there's a sort of discussion about Simon Harris's vulnerability. So there really is, there's just a remarkable sort of set of factors interacting
that
here.
That is certainly shedding light on lots
completely. And the last thing about Jim Gavin on paper is, of course, it seems like an eminently qualified candidate, but he's completely untried. And again, this is going back to the Mary McAleese playbook of 1997, where somebody was untried, but with the might of Fianna Fáil behind her.
Mary McAleese had also had run for election before that and had
she
been
had, but
politics.
Nothing at the level of prominence or whatever that this is. So that's
okay.
Well,
Liz, to balance the scales then on Jim Gavin. You picked a piece, it's actually in the sports section of the Sunday Independent. Joe Brawley is writing about Jim Gavin, and I think Joe Brawley's fairly black and white on people. You're either amazing or you're the worst in the world. So anyway, Jim Gavin for now is amazing.
What a gift for a candidate to have. You know, this is the thing that candidates and campaigns dream of, is to have, you know, right in the middle of the sports section, something absolutely glowing and completely uncritical about you. When, as Mary said, you know, you haven't actually left the door or even said that you're, you know, said very much yet. But I think to Alan's point about how late, you know, this is all kind of happening, like, it's September tomorrow. You know, tomorrow we'll be able to say next month's election. And, you know, I'm under 45. If you're under 45, you've had two presidential elections your whole life, right? So we're not kind of used to this. And, you know, you've never had a Fianna Fáil candidate on the ballot, right? You know, because if you turned 18 any time after 1997. And so, you know, we're in this situation where...
Hang on.
Yeah.
So seeing as you say that, does this seem like an election from... another era, another generation, with people from another generation.
It's weird. It's really weird. So, you know, in the papers today, you've got all of these kind of highly energetic reports out of Electric Picnic the last 2 days being this all-night political fest, right?
Yeah.
You have Hozier.
We will come back to that.
And so popular culture at the moment is highly political in Ireland and in lots of other parts of the world. People are engaged and they want this fight. And we, you know, we pay political parties state money, right? They have all of these privileges in nominating candidates because they have an important role in Irish society. And the main one, find candidates for us to vote for. I'm now getting calls from my friends saying, did I see something about, oh, you know, I feel really bad. I've missed out on this whole presidential election thing. What's going on? And I have to say, listen, there's no candidates. There's one candidate at the moment to vote for. It, like, frankly, it feels disrespectful.
Okay.
And, you know, it, like, we're coming into September now. Hopefully, you know, on your show next week, we'll actually have, you know, you'll have a suite of candidates to be talking about. But this is their job.
Okay. Put on your headphones there for a minute. excuse me. Mary Hanafin, former Fianna Fáil Minister. Good morning.
Morning, Brendan.
Mary, you had expressed an interest in running as Fianna Fáil's candidate for the presidency. Are you putting yourself forward?
No, I'm afraid it looks like I'm going to have to stay on the bench on this one.
Why?
And let Dublin Cork fight it out. I knew at the outset that, I mean, I couldn't achieve getting the nomination unless I had the backing of the leadership. And when I came out in July saying that I was interested in Conor Feehan's article on kind of lifestyle and resilience, at the same time I was saying two things. One, that I was very disappointed, as Mary was saying there now, at the number of people, and Alan, that were ruling themselves out rather than ruling themselves in. And the fact that at that stage Fianna Fáil looked like they weren't going to run a candidate at all, which was the height of disrespect to the office. So I had spoken with Micheál Martin, had a good chat with them, and a very positive chat.
Positive or negative towards your aspirations?
No, at that stage, and I think you asked me this very same question when I was on your programme, actually, when I did.
But you can say no, because you're not afraid of him anymore.
In fairness, he was. He said to me, look, I guess if you're Tipperary, you've got Dublin, you're a teacher, you're a barrister, you had a good record in education, have Gaelgaeilge, you know. So, I mean, he could see that there were a lot of things that I had going for me. I'm quite sure there were a lot of things I hadn't. But I just took the opportunity.
Did he encourage you?
To go around. He didn't discourage me.
Okay.
And he encouraged me to go to, I said, my type of campaign would be one which would be around the country, going to different events, meeting people, doing the community kind of focus, and that I would like to start immediately. And he said, well, go ahead and do that, which I actually did. And I went everywhere from the Clonakilty Band Festival to Lenties to the Fla to the Horse Show, you know, and thoroughly enjoyed.
When did you realise it was all changing and the game had moved on?
Unfortunately, in Fianna Fáil, you tend to read an awful lot in the newspapers. So I could see that I wasn't getting favourable comment in the newspaper, but I was on a flight back from my holidays last Monday morning, and as soon as I landed, I opened it up and I saw Jim Gavin. I said, well, that's it.
Do you feel you were treated with respect in the whole process?
I was certainly treated with respect at the very beginning of it. As it came towards the end, I have to say, and I said this to Micheál Martin the other night, a phone call would have made a difference, just to say, look, sorry, Mayor, we're not running with you. And I would have accepted that, Brendan. You know, it's an enormous position. And I know they want the very best candidate. And if I'm not to be that candidate, I would have accepted it. But even a phone call...
Did you see Bertie Ahern talking at the De Valera commemoration
He's worse than I was, to be honest now. Because Bertie said he had indicated last December and at Easter and everything else. He's a former Taoiseach. He's a former party leader. He should have been told, sorry, this is not a runner.
Yeah. But you think you should have been told at some point as well?
Well, even before Jim Gavin was announced, to say, you know, it's a simple phone call. I know Micheál Martin said, oh, you would have wanted to know who the candidate was. I said, no, I understand cabinet confidentiality. You know, I wouldn't.
Okay. Are you disappointed?
I had a great time thinking about it.
Are you disappointed?
No, to be honest, Brendan, I mean this genuinely, I got a lot of encouragement from people I met around the country who would know my record. I would have given the job absolutely everything, and I think could have carried it off. I wouldn't have been everybody's type of candidate. I would hope that I would have reflected the type of values, etc. But now, I'm also very fortunate. As you know, I think you called me a baby barrister this time last year. I was just called to the bar. I've had a wonderful year devilling with Breffni Gordon. I've had huge experience. And now I can just take flight as a barrister in a new legal career.
Okay, stay with us, Mary Hannafin. Oisín, you want to come in there. What do you think of that?
And I think this shows that the desire by the leadership to have complete control of the media story has resulted in the opposite, because they didn't want to tell Bertie Ahern or Mary Hannafin a straight answer because they were afraid it would leak. And as a result, they waited so long and the people themselves came out and said, why did no one tell us? Like, I think the leadership could have been much more straightforward and transparent about what the process would be internally, and they wouldn't be in this problem. Because they have actually an interesting suite of candidates, from Eamon O'Caoimh to Bertie Ahern. There's an interesting article from Colm Murphy in the paper, but it would be good to have these candidates, not just from Fianna Fáil, out there representing different strands of Irish society. And that's not happening, as Liz has said.
Mary?
Like, it strikes me that Micheál Martin hasn't got off the phone for the past 3 days. And it would seem that if he'd made a few phone calls over the summer, when he wasn't on the phone, it would have saved him an awful lot of hassle, because Mary Hannafin is now saying,
a bit of a mess, yeah?
Mary Hannafin is now saying, you know, she wasn't told that she wasn't being, she was out, basically. Bertie Ahern is saying that he didn't get the contact at all whatsoever.
And he seems to be saying he got onto them repeatedly, was told they'd tell him by Easter, then got onto them again, was told they'd tell him before he went to Kerry, and nothing.
Well, it struck me when he spoke at that De Valera commemoration outside Glasnevin Cemetery that he was preparing that answer very carefully. He had all his dates.
And he held the question till the end.
Yeah, exactly.
It was very well
put
together.
So he went through it chronologically. Billy Kelleher said that he had no idea when he made the intervention 2 weeks ago that he did, calling for an urgent meeting of the parliamentary party. He had no idea at that stage that Jim Gavin's name was in the mix. Micheál Martin said he didn't know Billy Kelleher was considering it. So this whole waiting game throughout the summer and not talking to anyone means now he finds himself in a situation, the party leader, where he's on the phones non-stop to ensure he gets his man over the line.
Mary Hannafin, do you think Bertie Ahern has been very clear to say, well, I haven't ruled myself out, so therefore I'm still in. Does he have some kind of pathway here to actually putting himself forward, if only to kind of queer the pitch or something, to go for the Fianna Fáil convention?
I don't believe he has, because half of the parliamentary party has either been appointed ministers, junior ministers, committee chairs, or was appointed to the Senate. So there's a huge sense of loyalty to the party leader there. And it's very hard to overcome that number. On the other hand, we'll say for Billy, who's a member of the parliamentary party, there will be personal loyalties to him. So you'd have that.
Do you think Billy Kelleher can win?
I think there's three battles going on briefly. I think there's the Dublin Cork one. right? There's Dublin, Cork. The idea we already have candidates who are coming from Galway and Monaghan, and the whole of the Dublin vote. Whether Billy can move beyond Cork, move beyond Munster would be a question, I think. Jim Gavin, already through Joe Brawley, seems to be garnering support from the GAA across the country. Second thing, which is a kind of a fundamental issue for the Fianna Fáil party, is do we go for one of our own or do we go for an outsider? And I think that's the debate that will probably happen over the next week or so. And the third thing then is loyalty to the leader or loyalty to a friend and a good colleague like Billy Kelleher. So there are three battles that are happening this week.
Okay, but you think it's hard to see Billy Kelleher win those battles?
I think it's very hard to win a battle in the parliamentary party if you do not have the backing of the party,
okay,
of the party leader.
I saw Jim Gavin's name
and I saw that, well, I said Kerry, Mayo, Tyrone, they couldn't beat Jim Gavin. I mean, I certainly wouldn't be able to.
But it sounds like it could leave scars as well.
Sorry, Brendan, it won't leave a scar if we win.
Oh, yeah, okay, right.
The Fianna Fáil candidate wins the election.
Now, there are, of course, other candidates. In fact, there's only one candidate as things stand, Catherine Connolly. Alan Bard, Alison O'Connor, is writing about her in the Sunday Times today.
It's a very focused article, and the headline, I suppose, is less than complimentary. I think it makes reference to Catherine Connolly more suited to student union politics, which I think is very unfair. I mean, Catherine Connolly has, you know, had a distinguished political career, but I guess Alison is pointing out to some of the, let's call them the Achilles heels. Now, I mean, I've heard Catherine Connolly talk about these sort of things, so I think if she was here, she has answered various questions. So there's the ongoing discussion about her trip to Syria, which also involved Wallace and Claire Daly. And that seems to be a shadow that hangs over her. I think,
she obviously, we just says she was out there to observe.
Well, that's exactly
war,
it. I mean, I have heard her address some of these issues. I guess the most recent ones are when she talked about that you couldn't trust the United States, the United Kingdom and France. I mean, that was reported during the week. Again, this is one of these sort of things that there might be sort of shifting positions. I don't know where the population of Ireland generally is. But I mean, I think in a context where I think we get increasingly worried about our relationship with the United States, I think there is a sense here that we may have to have a sort of a stronger connection with the European partners. So, you know, talking about a distrust to people like the UK and France as well, that is something that may not sit particularly well. I think Catherine Connolly is going to just make the final. Yeah. I think Catherine Connolly's biggest difficulty might be, though, in some sense, she might be viewed as the sort of the successor, the ideological successor of Michael D. Higgins. But I think Michael D. had a very broad appeal amongst people who may not have shared his political views, because there's something innately charming and sort of captivating about Michael D. Higgins. I don't think Catherine Connolly, in the same way that most people are not as captivating or charismatic as Michael D., but I think that would be the difficulty. And the point I made earlier on, it's not entirely clear to me that Labour people will be voting with her for enthusiasm, or indeed Sinn Féin people will transfer.
Liz Carlin, and what you were saying earlier about the young people, etc. Is Catherine Connolly a bit more in tune with them? Having listened to all that stuff about all those men in Fianna Fáil, you know, fighting each other in that old style political way, that which is how politics works in the country, does Catherine Connolly seem a bit more in tune with the people at the electric picnic?
I'm not sure. I mean, there was some reporting in the Irish Times yesterday that she's raised, I think, €50,000, mostly in small donations. You said the average is about €30 per person. And I looked back, and Michael D. in 2018 only raised about €35. And overall, like, you know, donations tend to be quite low in presidential elections. Campaigns tend to be self-funded or kind of party funded. And she said she's got 5,000 volunteers. So there's clearly, I think, a kind of cohort of people who are kind of getting behind her. I do wonder, though, you know, that it's mentioned in, I think anytime you see her name, you see Claire Daly, Mick Wallace, Gemma O'Doherty. Like, I think there are certain things there that more, you know, young people are politically engaged, they are clued in, they know who these people are, and they have opinions on them. But, you know, like...
she'd probably kind of the candidates there are there so far, She'd probably be the candidate you would, a person like you, would naturally most gravitate towards.
I guess I have a lefty liberal background or whatever. But I do think, I can think Liz is onto something, the discussion on something. I think there's something we will find out during this election, which is that, you know, she's very respected, as Alan said, very respected parliamentarian and did a good job as last Cairn Corlan. She's very strong on Gaza and so on. But having been rightly critical, as many people are, of US imperialism, for want of a better phrase, over decades, there was part of the left for whom that also meant sort of being soft on Russia. And for a while that didn't really matter. Post the Soviet Union, that was maybe not much of an issue. Once Putin started doing what he's been doing in Crimea and now in Ukraine, the rest of Ukraine, that changes that equation.
Yeah, Catherine Connolly has condemned that war, sure, but she has a more nuanced view on NATO actions.
Yes,
in
and
the run up
to be
to
fair,
that
look, there are US foreign policy analysts who think that NATO overplayed their hand in Eastern Europe. But of course, once Russia invades a sovereign country that is democratic and wants to be democratic,
so in simple optics, not great.
So I think that's a challenge. I think
Mary,
that's a challenge.
Can we just before we leave this? We will have a Fine Gael candidate on Tuesday, right?
Yes. Yeah. So Heather Humphrey's coronation, as it were, the longest taking coronation ever, will be announced officially on Tuesday. Heather Humphrey's will become the Fine Gael candidate. So at that
point, will a party unite behind her, or is there possibly going to be a little bit of soreness about how Sean Kelly was treated?
The party will unite behind her. They get Fine Gael tend to get very excited about their candidates. They're, you know, Leo Varadkar was a great white hope. Simon Harris was a great white hope for Fine Gael. And they do see in Heather Humphreys someone who can bring now a sort of winning streak that the party really badly needs, a win on something at this stage. The party will unite behind her, but I think there will be something residual there about how Sean Kelly was, as I said, steamrolled, that he didn't even get a chance to go out and present himself. I think there are people who believe that might have been a good process for the party. You know, they didn't have a leadership contest for Simon Harris. There was one between Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney, but it was almost, you know, pretty much over before it begun. So, like, that sort of internal conversation in Fine Gael is probably something that the party could do with. But they will get behind her on Tuesday, and her campaign will get well underway at that point. Okay. It'll be interesting to see if Sean Kelly himself has anything to say about how that process played out for him.
Okay. Our panel staying with us, Liz Carlin, Oisín Coughlan, Mary Regan and Professor Alan Barr. We'll take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Liz Carlin, Oisín Coughlan, Mary Regan and Professor Alan Barr. So Liz, you referred earlier to Electric Picnic and Kneecap and all that. And you have picked, there's a piece in the Sunday Times, Kneecap Charge Up Electric Picnic with Gaza Fury by Patrick O'Donoghue. There's a piece by Eve Ferrooney in the Sunday Independent, Kneecap Remake Electric Picnic as an all-night political party. So just expand there on what you were starting to say earlier.
Yeah, there's just, you know, it's all of the coverage coming out of Electric Picnic. There's always a kind of narrative every year. And normally it's, you know, was everyone sunburned or was there wellies? This year, the narrative coming out is about this deeply political energy and bent that seems to have pervaded the entire festival. And it comes to, there was another piece in the Sunday Times about the protester, Kitty O'Brien, who was attacked in, well, not attacked, who was protesting in Berlin. And Irish representatives have basically made a complaint because they believe she was
assaulted.
And
people will have seen that video. They were. Kitty O'Brien was like, they went in fairly hard on them, didn't they?
They had blood on their face when they were punched again.
Are you saying, okay, this is really broad, simplistic way of saying it. Is this in a weird way this generation's Vietnam that has politicised them and galvanised them? Irish generation's
very
Vietnam?
Much so, very much so. I mean, I think you know, the violence that was evident in Berlin, and there's other videos going around as well. There's another video of a girl who got grabbed by the neck. There's obviously a huge amount of solidarity within Ireland towards what's happening in Gaza. Nisha Dolan has a piece as well in the paper explaining her decision to join the flotilla that's going over there. But there's also kind of a fight to be even to be able to protest. Like, I think this, it was so visual what happened to Kitty in Berlin, and, you know, went viral, and people will have seen it. I believe it was on the news. You know, it kind of echoes what happened to Mokara, or what's happening to Mokara with the British legal system. You know, this suppression of dissent, this suppression of protest, which feels a part of a kind of like a broader anti-democratic
really
movement.
Just to be specific on it, like, and I mean, not taking any side in it, but that this specific on Mokara is not against him calling out Palestine. It's about waving a Hezbollah flag.
It is.
Yeah. But I'm not saying that this justifies anything.
That is important to point out. But there has also been large-scale arrests of, you know, peaceful protesters in the UK because of their association with a pro-Palestinian group who have been proscribed as a terrorist organisation by the UK government. And, you know, I'm sure Oisin has all sorts of views on just that very basic right to protest.
This is not helping anything, is it? Well, the way the protesters are being treated.
No, and I think it's really important to, because I had to go and read up about this a few weeks ago, to clarify this issue of the British government prescribing an organisation as a terrorist organisation. It's not that they think they're unlike Hezbollah, that they're terrorists in the Middle East. Palestine Action has been prescribed in the UK for spray painting warplanes in the UK. That's the terrorist action they're prescribed for.
Yeah.
And that's what Sally Rooney's being threatened with arrest for, because she says that she's going to keep funding them. Interesting, Nisha Dolan and Sally Rooney, the same generation as the people supporting NICAP. I think it shows how out of step the UK government is. There was somebody arrested in the UK for holding a placard of an Ian Hislop cartoon from Private Eye, I should say, which said, "Explaining Palestine Action, acceptable, shooting Gazans queuing for food, unacceptable, spray painting warplanes." And the person was arrested for holding that cartoon on the street in Britain. So that's how odd, absurd it's got in the UK. And someone had arrested for having a T-shirt that said, "Plasticine Action," with a photograph of Morph in it, the BBC character. He was eventually released when the policeman's boss said, "Oh, have you looked at his T-shirt?" That's how ridiculous it's getting, and it's not surprising. As you say, it's Vietnam. It's become this generation's mobilising moment. And it's also because it's playing out on our screens live, this slow, extended, genocidal starvation we're seeing in Gaza. And it's very hard to watch, but it's impossible to take your eyes off it.
Alan.
Just two quick points. I mean, firstly, the conversation around the table has drifted a little bit in talking about, you know, this generation's Vietnam and everything like that. But just to be clear, I mean, this is affecting all generations, okay, in terms of the horror that we're witnessing. I mean, I think if you look at the Vietnam protests of the 1960s, it probably was led by young people and college students and everything like that. But I mean, I think across the generations, we have all been shocked, and in my case, almost to speechlessness as I think about it now, about what's happening. But just to, it's another point, maybe this is unfair to bring J.D. Vance in at this stage, but on issues of protest, J.D. Vance spoke a number of months ago, for example, about the rights of people to protest at abortion clinics. And he was complaining about European sort of, you know, not allowing free speech. I find it extraordinary then that there's no revulsion expressed about, you know, what's happening in terms of Palestine and people's, you know, the right to protest.
I think we have to say the US just decided they will not allow the president of the Palestinian Authority into New York to go to the UN General Assembly.
Where the state of Palestine is going to be recognised by multiple countries.
It's against the deal between the US and the UN to be in New York. And I would say that, I was struck recently when Keir Starmer and
Benjamin Netanyahu, international arrest warrants out.
Was allowed. So one quick point. I mean, Keir Starmer and Macron went with Zelensky to the US to make sure he wasn't ambushed a second time. I think the Irish government should invite Abbas here, and let's see Micheál Martin and Simon Harris go with him from here to the US. That would be the sort of international solidarity Ireland could show on the diplomatic side.
Mary Regan, politically, the Irish government has been way ahead of the curve and remains way ahead of a lot of Europe on this. But they still seem to be coming off on the wrong side of it for a lot of people, that it's not enough.
Yeah, and I think the government figures are kind of surprised by that, saying, you know, we've led the way in Europe in terms of much of this. We've even risked, you know, damaging relations with the US, for example, over this issue. And yet the sense coming from the public and the Irish public, and particularly, I think, the younger generation that we talk about, is that it's not going far enough. And Nisha Dolan, writing in today's Sunday Independent, is saying that in 2 days' time, on September 2nd, she's saying the central bank is due to renew its approval of what are described as Israeli war bonds. And that seems to be a sort of point of difficulty, I think, for the government. Sinn Féin were quite, strategic, I think, in Mairead Farrell, who is now chair of the Finance Committee, calling the governor of the central bank in to discuss and to explain the approval of Israeli war bonds. But that seems to be an issue that is causing damage now to the government, where in many ways it's a very sort of technical, kind of boring, central banky sort of procedural issue, but it's something that people are sort of rallying around and getting angry about right now.
And there was another small piece in The Independent that picked up on a story that The Guardian broke earlier in the month about an investigation they did that found that data centres in Ireland were being used as part of this kind of big surveillance operation by the Israeli military that was likely being used to kind of target some of the attacks that were going on. And so the update in the paper today is, you know, Microsoft, they seem to have launched an internal investigation. Google and Amazon didn't sort of reply and have this answer. And it seems to be one of these topics that's seeping into everything. I think there was another story about how around the bonds, you know, the central bank are having to look at getting safety concerns.
That's their only
Central bank staff are concerned about the war bonds.
In fairness to the Irish state, I mean, I am proud of most of the position that the Irish state has done. And I think a lot of us can be, in terms of like our government's constant reiteration of this being about international law and the protection of human rights. I think that the positioning is really strong on it. There's just so many interconnected pieces in our economy, in being part of a global trade system, in being part of...
Alan, briefly before
It's on your specific point about the government maybe being disappointed on occasions that they don't feel they're getting enough credit for their stance on Gaza. I think one of the problems for them is the situation gets continually worse and continually more horrific and continually more shocking. So what would have been accepted like as a sort of a worthwhile response a year ago, in the light of things like the humanitarian crisis and the shooting at people and stuff like that, it really just gets worse and worse. And I think it's very difficult for them to stay on top of that. And at every given point, I think people are just looking for more dramatic action to counter what is just an absolutely horrific situation.
Okay, we have politics is kicking off at home again, Mary. The Sunday Times, page 2, Foley faces fight over plan to cut childcare costs. This is Norma Foley. But this is actually the beginning of the budget battles, which we're not talking about at all at the moment, but that's all we'll be talking about for a month from next week, probably, isn't it?
There's been surprisingly little on the budget compared to every other year. And part of it is because everyone's so preoccupied with the presidential nomination.
You can only focus on one thing at a
exactly
time in this country.
Can't multitask with their brains. No. But another reason is that, you know, someone described it to me as this is going to be a sort of lastminute.com budget. They're leaving it late in the day to have all these important discussions, partially just because of the sort of uncertainty about what was happening with tariffs and where the economy was headed. Partly because I think it now appears that the presidential election will be 2 weeks after the budget. So there's probably going to be a little bit of, you know...
So are they going to capitulate and find stuff down the back of the couch and give people a bit of an electricity credit or a double...
child
benefit.
I don't think we're going to see the sort of those so-called once-off cost of living measures repeated. But the sense was earlier in the year that this is a kind of post-election budget. So we don't need to make it very political or a vote-winning budget. But now if it's so close to the presidential election, in which we now know that Fianna Fáil will have a candidate, that wasn't a certainty before the budget or before the summer. Fine Gael will have a candidate and possibly Sinn Féin will have a candidate, and Sinn Féin would use that presidential election, I think, to raise issues around, you know, cost of living and all the things.
They're already doing it around head on.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, it will be a political budget, I think. In that sense.
Okay, so sweeties.
But childcare is one area that there has been huge promises on. It became a big issue during the election campaign. And the promise is to bring it down to €200 cap a month. But just how much they can go in this budget is sort of seems to be a bit of a contentious issue. And of course, feeding into all of that is Fine Gael's wish to have the VAT rate for hospitality down to 9%, which leaves small change in an awful lot of other areas.
Okay. Alan, you picked a piece, Back to Work for Ministers with Tariffs, Budget, Housing and Presidential Race on List by Cornel Thomas in the Business Post. So just with your economist hat on then, and if we get back away from like who should be the president, back to there is serious business to be done and also a very serious outlook facing us. What's your general view on where things are at for the economy, what kind of a budget we can afford, what are the downwind threats that we're looking at now? Are you optimistic, pessimistic?
A bit of both. Mary suggested earlier on that we weren't thinking enough, but I'm happy to report that the economics community in Ireland is forever thinking about budgetary matters, and we've been thinking about this one as well. It's yeah, it's a tricky one to call. Okay, for the following reason, the economy is still in a remarkably good phase. I mean, we had numbers out over the last week or two, for example, showing employment is still increasing at a very strong rate. Tax revenues are still increasing at a strong rate. So there's an awful lot of positives. We were very worried, obviously, a number of months ago about Trump and tariffs and what might happen there. The 15% has landed. It's not ideal, but it's not worst case scenario
doable,
or anything like that. I think it's doable. It's doable in a macroeconomic sense, okay, in the sense if you look across the economy, this is not going to have catastrophic outcomes. That's not to say that for specific industries, okay, specific sectors, that there might be difficulties. But I think this is manageable. So what this actually does, it means we will go into the budgetary cycle. And back to some of the issues you were just touching on, when things are going reasonably well, then the expectations, of course, start increasing that we can do all the things, you know, that people would want. And just a little bit of perspective on it. I mean, if you go back over the last number of years, I mean, if you start with COVID, where there was phenomenal amounts of expenditure, and quite rightly, then we had Ukraine and the inflationary crisis, where there was all the, you know, the one-offs. And then we moved into an election cycle. So really, for the past 5 or 6 years, I think the population has generally got used to very generous budgets. And you can see this in the numbers, that even though surpluses are being run, if you strip out those particularly buoyant tax numbers from the corporation tax side, there's actually a fragility in the public finances that people don't understand. So I think ideally what should be happening is that this should be, I think, a tighter budget than we've become used to. I mean, I think back to that frailty in the public finances, we are still reliant to too great a degree on corporate tax revenues that the department themselves talk about, you know, the bits that we can't really explain. They're nothing to do with Irish economic activity. They're related to a whole range of other things. So I think a degree of prudence would be the mantra.
So I'm taking prudent optimism from you there.
Yeah, but again, but of course, that's before all the demands start reining in. And the but on the childcare one, this is another fascinating one, because the government, of course, is talking about reducing the cost of childcare. But the issue in a whole range of parts of the country is not about the cost, it's about the availability. So we're back to this issue that the economy is really running at full employment. In many ways, some of the constraints facing the economy and the government are not about the availability of cash. It's about the availability, for example, by construction workers to build up the houses, and again in childcare to do the sort of things that are there.
Liz, there's a few pieces about, there's a massive background to all of this as well, and to all our futures, which is AI embodied in data centres in a way. Before we come to the data centres, Charlie Taylor has an interesting piece in the Business Post, Inside the Tech BBQ, Adapt or Die, the AI agent era is happening right now. And I suppose there has been a narrative around that America really is owning this, China to an extent as well, but that Europe is the old world when it comes to a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, so Charlie's has a report from Copenhagen, and It reads like some sort of silicon, you know, not this isn't Charlie, this is, you know, he's quoting, yeah, like, for example, the head of LinkedIn kind of saying, you know, we need to adapt or die, you know, people need to adapt or die, you need a growth mindset, fear of change, you know, is something that you're just going to have to work through. Like, it sounds like Maggie Thatcher if she became like a mental health kind of influencer, like, yeah, it's just this really weird kind of therapy speak layered on top of this like entirely individualistic understanding of the economy without grasping any concept of macroeconomics or or, you know, like the labor movement or social equity or anything else.
And yeah,
like
that's the trend. These people are running the American president now as well, aren't they? And that's, you know, the reality of it.
There was a piece about the visit that Kamishu Naman suffered earlier in the year from US officials who were, in the Mail on Sunday, who were making these very strong overtures about, you know, free speech, which is quite ironic, as Alan pointed out earlier. And it's part
this
of this
Ken
order.
Fox in the Mail.
Ken Fox in the Mail.
They labelled our hate speech law.
Exactly. Ken had to, from the sounds of it, do some quite strong freedom of information requests. So good on Ken for getting this out to us. But, you know, like, there is this, it's mentioned in a few of the papers, it came up again this week, this idea not only of, you know, potentially there being additional tariffs and trade barriers to countries who are regulating these very small group of companies that the Trump administration is in bed with, but also now restricting visas. And this is something that was mentioned a couple of months ago by the US Secretary of State, and it now seems to be potentially becoming policy, restricting visas to policymakers in Europe who are trying to regulate tech, which is just the most absurd abuse of State Department powers.
And yet probably doesn't surprise us in a way.
No.
And then, Oisin, on to the data centres. Big mistake, billions at risk as data centres forced out of Dublin. This is Laura Roddy in the Business Post. Did you know, by the way, did you see this figure about how there was more construction went on in data centres in the last 12 months than went on of traditional offices or manufacturing? Data centres is this massive, massive industry now. It's been financialised into financial instruments that nobody understands, and people do seem to think there's this whole thing going on here that we don't fully understand financially or in any other way, and it's just happening.
Yeah, so the one thing we do understand, and this is what this article is about, is to some degree, is its energy consumption. Like, it's using half of all the electricity in the Dublin area and 22% of all electricity in the country right now before this next phase of growth happens, which is why, and I have issues with some of what the CRU is doing, that's the Commissions for the Regulation of Utilities, but it's why that they are saying you can't have more data centres in Dublin, there just isn't actually electricity capacity for it, and why the government might then decide they still want to be seen to encourage it, so they encourage it to be built around the country near where offshore wind will come on. Because in 15 years, we might have plenty of offshore wind to run plenty of data centres. The issue is, right now, as the Secretary General of the Department of Environment said, it's competing with housing. And I do actually worry that even this idea of saying, let go and build it in the southeast where the wind energy will come on shore, is that it might actually pollute the debate about wind energy. If people think the purpose of wind energy is just to have more data centres, they will resist the grid and resist the wind turbines even more if it's seen to be for big tech and big companies, okay, and not for heating our homes and driving our cars,
yeah,
which is what
yeah.
it actually needs to be for.
Yeah, and on the other hand, they are the engine of the future, and they are the engine of the industries
that
have made us.
Well, it's a bit of an AI bubble. Liz would know more about this than me. Like, if you read the financial pages...
Well, is it going to ever pay for itself?
Well, I think what might happen is you get a dot-com crash like 2001, and now ultimately it becomes profitable, but right now it's speculative
bubble. That seems to be the concern at the moment. Okay, Liz Carlin, Oisin Coughlan, Mary Regan and Professor Alan Bard staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Liz Carlin, Oisin Coughlan, Mary Regan and Professor Alan Barrett. Oisin, before we get to what you all really want to talk about, which is Taylor Swift, there is a piece in the Mail on Sunday today by Niamh Walsh, RTE braces for exodus of stars as Claire makes €2 million move.
Yeah, so there's a fair bit of coverage in the papers today about the kind of the big musical chairs or talk radio chairs that happened on Friday, with Claire Byrne announcing she was leaving here to replace Pat Kenny in News Talk, and David McCullough coming to the Today programme on RT1 at 10 a.m. But this article is interesting in that there's whoever's briefing Niamh Walsh from behind the scenes in RTE, saying that this is, on the one hand, we're losing Joe Duffy and Claire Byrne, but on the other hand, it allows the senior management in RTE now to try and reimagine RTE1 for 10 years' time, for 2035, and how do you bring in younger listeners, and this is potentially a chance for generational change, although obviously Claire Byrne's not that old. So it's not quite clear here what they mean by that, and when they say people might leave, who they expect to leave, although they do talk about trying to potentially attract people like some of the broadcasters in News Talk, like Kieran Cuddihy. So it's not clear exactly what they mean, but there's a sense that this may be beyond simply somebody moving to get a better job, that is an opportunity for, or it's part of a bigger shift in RTE.
Okay, you have about less than a minute each on Taylor Swift. Mary, you've gone on the engagement rings side of this, Niamh Horan in the Sunday Indo.
Yeah, because as Niamh says, we all know that Taylor Swift gives economic bounces. You know, she is the real economic story right now. But not only that, there is a new Swift effect, which is that Irish couples apparently are paying up to a quarter of $1 million, $250,000, on engagement rings. It quotes Nicholas Appleby of Appleby Jewellers. He's a gemologist. Like, why didn't I do that in college? And he's saying that, he said, I'll put it this way, on any given day in our shop, you'd be selling something for $2,500. And at the same time, we could be selling something for $250,000. And then he gives a lovely description of the people who come into the shop, from plumbers to the head of an aircraft leasing company, all with the same sense of romance. And also that the ring that Taylor Swift got is, by all accounts, according to our gemologist, near impossible to find on planet Earth. Another reason why we all just love this particular love story.
Liz Carlin, Brenda Power is writing about the return of marriage in the Sunday Independent. But you do think that this is a new side of Taylor Swift we're seeing, or a kind of a cultural shift there, yeah?
I mean, I personally have been waiting for this for a very long time. There's lots of, you know, this has launched a thousand think pieces.
Why is marriage still the ultimate?
So Brenda has a piece, and she says that Swift is redefining marriage. And Donal Lynch had a piece as well. And like, the word tradwife keeps coming up, as if it's as if the people who are writing about this seem to be stuck in an idea of marriage that I don't think kind of exists for people anymore.
I think people are going, like, there was an interesting piece in the FT yesterday that she's giving MAGA energy now, because she's like being the girlfriend of the football player, and that it was all very traditional looking, like.
But I mean, you know, Taylor assumes a role, a character, right, for 6 months at a time, and then she is something else. At the same time, she put out an album cover last week where she's wearing a few little diamantes and practically nothing else. I mean, this is, she's a master storyteller. I have no idea what she's like as a real person, but her story that she has told us over the last 20 years is something that I am absolutely fully bought
into.
And
you like this new chapter?
Well, I mean, you know, what I dislike about it is just this idea of marriage as something which is a kind of like a trap, or, you know, like the word tradwife keeps coming up. I mean, they are two very successful people who are kind of merging their, you know, financial and social lives, and more power to them.
Okay, yeah. I don't think anyone was criticising her for getting married. Oisín, are you critical of her for getting married? How dare she?
No, not at all. I mean, we all know we live in an attention economy. I mean, in my 14-year-old daughter is more of an Olivia Rodrigo fan than Taylor Swift, so I hear more of that. But I do think, thank God, there's somebody who can out-compete Trump for attention. Like, there's one person in the world who can push him off the front pages. And even he, even though she endorsed Biden, even he had to come out and congratulate her on her engagement. So I'm glad there's somebody who's still more powerful than Trump.
Okay, and we leave it at that. Thanks very much to our excellent panel today, Liz Carlin, Oisín Coughlan, Mary Regan and Professor Alan Barrett. And now it's just 12 noon, and we'll go to the newsroom and Susan Jackson.